The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Great app. If you love a UK-based investment, who doesn't, let's be honest, there are two things you should subscribe to. This app and the accompanying podcast series. Real-time RNS and aggregated broker sentiment on the app. Great articles, as well as regulatory news. That's from 2018 OTD. Nice review there at the App Store. By the way, the app is free to download, Vox Markets app, of course. But if you do download it and you have got some value from it, please visit the App Store. Give us a decent rating and review, and I could read it out in the podcast. Okay, on the podcast today, Rob Proctor, Chief Executive Officer of Audioboom. Boom is the ticker there, of course. And Rob covers recent news, including their podcast content funding guarantee arrangement and their collaboration with Studio 71. I also have on the podcast Richard Hullihan, CEO of Polarion, P-O-L-X. And Richard discusses the progress they're making in their Phase 3 clinical trials and milestones coming up. I also have on the podcast today Jonathan Tobin, Investment Director at Arix Bioscience, A-R-I-X, a ticker there. And Jonathan discusses their portfolio, their investment process and strategy. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. And the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk. We'll see a host of other content.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Rob Proctor, CEO of Audioboom. The ticker there is Boom. Rob, thanks for joining me.
No worries. Good morning, Justin.
Yeah, first off the bat there, I had someone contact me, I think it was on Twitter, with your ticket going, boom, what's happened there? Big question mark, because if you look at the share price today, it shows 9,775% up. And I thought, that is a cracking bit of news, whatever they've released.
mate, we don't mess the audio boom, I tell you. No, I mean, obviously, we did share consolidation today. So we did 100-to-1 share consolidation. You know, the main driver for that is 85% of our business is out of the U.S. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to get U.S. institutional investors more interested in our business. And a lot of those, the U.S. institutions, they just have no comprehension of what a penny stock is.
Yeah.
Because obviously, you know, it relates to something different in the U.S.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't get on their radar. And given that the U.S. market, in the investment terms, absolutely, definitely gets podcasting, and we're a major player in that field. It's mad that we're not on their radar. So, I mean, that's the major reason for doing it.
Yeah,
I think it's also a sign that we're growing up, we're moving forward. You know, it's, you know, with the revenues that we're turning in now, kind of puts us in the realm where it just makes more sense that we are just seen to be, you know, not a penny stock at this point and are moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, there is a certain stigma attached to penny stocks. I love penny stocks, but I mean, like I said, there are fund managers out there who just look down their nose at penny stocks. So I understand that's a status thing, isn't it, really? But let's talk about some
it
news.
Can be.
Yeah. Let's talk about some news you've released. Let's go back to podcast content funding guarantee arrangement. What's all that about? Can you take us through that, Rob?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, I never join in on message boards, but I obviously see what's written on there. And you know, there was a very small piece in the Mail, or you know, I think it was the Mail the other day regarding this, mm-hmm. about how our shareholders, you know, we've run out of money, we've had to go back for more money, and mate, really? I mean, just read the announcement. Yeah. It's a guarantee facility inside an SPV, a special purpose vehicle. So basically, our chairman, Mike Tobin, and Candy Ventures are guaranteeing this vessel or vehicle. So if we've got a podcaster that maybe was looking for $1 million minimum guarantee or $1 million up front, instead of us actually having to pay that money out in one go, the SPV vehicle guarantees that $1 million over the life of the contract. We then pay it monthly, as in it's a monthly guarantee, through the life of that contract. So basically, the podcaster gets utter surety over the money that's coming in, and Audio Boom doesn't get the cash flow hit of having to put it out. For us as a company, it means we can bring on a caliber of podcast that can demand $1 million up front. You know, and you know, that $1 million could translate into anything between, you know, $2.5 to $8 million worth of revenue for the business. And I think the other key thing with this as well, and again, people have just either don't understand it or have not read it properly, we are paying the SPV 8% of the net money to Boom. So in simple, easy math, if it was 10 grand was the revenue that came in gross, and we had a 70-30 revenue split in the podcaster's favor, it means Audio Boom's money from that sale is 3,000. Mm-hmm. We then give the SPV 8% of that 3,000, which I think is somewhere in the region of 240, I think. So if you work that out against what the actual gross revenue was, as if you were doing that as a lending facility from the bank, it would come in at 2.4%, which is, yeah, pretty much on the money, if not a bit below, what it would cost you at a bank.
Yeah.
So, you know, the, like say, some of the messages about on the message board, they've obviously got a different agenda that they're trying to push, so maybe they're deliberately trying to state it wrongly. But yeah, all the information's in the SPV. And the other beauty of it is, you know, we obviously did the fundraise. We were going to raise more. The SPV facility came up as an opportunity. The dilution to shareholders from 10 million warrants issued at 2.5 million per 1 million of guarantee given to the SPB is a hell of a lot less than the dilution of raising another $4 million.
Yeah.
So again, it's a much better vehicle for all of our shareholders as well.
Yeah. And talking of bulletin boards, you mentioned there that there's been a couple of people talking about your margins. Can you explain the margin situation here? What's been saying?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, if anybody that was on the bulletin board had actually come to our ATM yesterday, Brad Clark, our CFO, gave a brilliant presentation on exactly how our model works and where it goes. But, you know, very top level and briefly, you know, we work with and kind of have three different forms of revenue streams and revenue shares, therefore gross margins. So we have our tier one publishers. Typically, they're at 75-25 revenue share in their favor. So we've got a 25% gross margin. We've got co-productions, where typically that's a 60-40 revenue share, but we do more of the work. So we retain 40% gross margin. And then we've got Audio Boom Originals, where typically we're making, after the cost of production, a 60% margin. And then the last area that we have is Sonic IM, which is our own buy-side media agency. And that Sonic is capable of buying advertising space from any podcast. Typically, with any media agency, it's a straight 15% margin to the agency. That's standard in the industry. It's standard in the whole media industry. I think what people won't know, unless they've been to any of the presentations, is what the sales mix, the overall sales mix, is between those streams. Now, I could tell you that we've alluded to it in many RNSs and what have you, but Sonic IM, our buy-side agency, we launched that in September last year. In Q4 of the year, so from launch, it did like $800,000, $900,000, something like that, which was great to kick off with. We are predicting it's going to be much more than that. We can see it's much more than that already. So it's one of our strong drivers of growth. which is amazing, and top-line revenue growth, which is amazing, but it's at a straight 15% margin. Now, if that bit is growing more quickly than the 25%, the 40%, and the 60% margin, then overall, it's clearly going to affect the gross margin for the entire group. So our core business of Tier 1 Podcasters, co-production, and AON is still our core business. Both margins haven't changed. But overall, because we've got such great growth in Summit, it appears to the outside world that our business model doesn't work and all their margins are going down. It's because those people don't understand how our business works.
Okay. Marvin, do you know what surprised me there? You talked about the big podcast stars are charging sort of upfront of $1 million. Is that the kind of money they're charging now? Because it's a big business now, isn't it?
It is. I mean, you know, the $1 million plus are exceptions. I mean, they're the top 1% of all podcasts that are made. You know, our top 250 is what drives, you know, probably 80% of our revenues. Of that 250, put it into context, we've only got 7 upfront payments and 15 minimum guarantees in play at the moment. So even within our top 50, this kind of usage and payment and, you know, the use of the SPV is reserved for the very top talent. And the reason we do it is because if we bring a podcast onto the platform, let's say it costs $1 million on the guarantee or as a minimum guarantee, we know exactly what that audience is because everybody is linked up to it via their RSS feed. Yeah. Because we know the size of the audience, we know in any particular content genre, whether it's true crime or sport or news, we know what the industry CPM is for that, what advertisers are willing to pay for that type of content, defined by how big the audience is. We know what our sell-through rate is, so how many of the available ad slots we are on average selling for that type of show of that type of size. And we know how many ad slots it takes. So we can work out exactly, before we even take that podcast on, what the minimum revenue expectation is for that show. Now, our minimum revenue expectation is normally somewhere around 1/3 of what our maximum revenue expectation would be. But we only base our upfront payments or minimum guarantees on the minimum revenue expectation. So we are insulated against loss. We have never lost money on a minimum guarantee or an upfront payment. Yeah. And more than that, because we own Sonic IM, and every podcaster on the planet wants Sonic to buy advertising from them, it means we have super accurate information from all of the podcasts that we go in and negotiate with. So again, we aren't making assumptions. We're not, you know, maybe we'll do this and, or wouldn't it be good if it grew to that? And no, we base everything on what it does today, and we base our minimum guarantees on that. But as I say, we've only got 7 upfront and 15 minimum guarantees in play out of 4.5, nearly 5,000 podcasters that we look after today.
Yeah. And talking of content and deals there, you've just done a deal with, is it Studio 21, is that correct?
Studio 71, out of LA. Yeah, they're based in LA, part of Red Arrow Studios, but they're actually owned overall by ProSiebens out of Germany. So they're huge. Yeah, Studio 71, I guess, probably the biggest YouTube channel owner on the planet. They get 7 to 8 billion video views every month and have huge social media stars. So the two girls that are coming on the platform, obviously we've launched that now, Oh Honey. Between them, they've got just around 48 million social media followers. Both of them do a lot of video. They're funny, they're entertaining, they're engaging. I mean, out of 48 million, let's say 10% of those people, well, no, let's be accurate. So 27% of the US population listens to a podcast. Obviously, in the under 35 age group, which is what the social influencers talk to, it's much higher. But let's use 27%. That means somewhere in the region of 12 to 13 million, maybe a bit more people, that are on their social channels also listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
And let's say of that 13 million, 10% of those would actually listen to a podcast, which again is probably being stupid because we already know that 10% of them or 27% listen to podcasts. But even if it was only 10%, you could have a very realistic expectation that that podcast would do a minimum of 1.3 million listens per episode once it gets embedded and established. That would easily make it Audio Boom's biggest show and a top 20 worldwide podcast.
And
that deal with Studio 71 is kind of the first major launch we've done with them. We look after a couple of smaller things for them. First major launch, we're going to be launching another 7 or 8 over the next 6 or 7 months, all with Studio 71.
Mm-hmm. Marvelous. It's just amazing what some of these new sort of influencers have. I mean, my sons watch YouTube a lot. So, I mean, they don't watch TV anymore, and they watch guys who have, almost 10, I think guys called Dolby Brothers. They have over 10 million subscribers. And literally, they will put a video out, it'll get more views than, say, BBC One Prime Time will get. And it's a new era,
easily.
Isn't it? You know?
Yeah, they easily get more views than the BBC will get. Without any doubt whatsoever. I mean, this is a different era. And I have to say, you know, we work closely with a lot of radio groups and all that good stuff. And, you know, we'll work more closely with them in the future. The radio groups are now realizing that the listeners are moving to on-demand of podcasting, exactly the same way that viewers of terrestrial normal TV are now moving to the catch-up and streaming channels like Amazon Prime and Netflix, as well as YouTube and Hulu and all those other places. So, you know, that move from traditional broadcast radio to podcasting is now an avalanche at this point. But excellently, the radio stations have gone, hang on, guys, we're the experts at making this audio. Yeah, we've got to do it a bit differently, and the content's got to be a bit different. But we've already got the wherewithal and the reach to be able to do it really effectively. So we're super excited to, you know, look forward to working with guys like iHeart and those people as they move forward, because they have a great future in this industry as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Okay, and how is, at the moment, how is business, how is operations going?
Business is great. So, you know, we built our own new back office system for inventory management and ad management, and that backs into Xero, and we do all of our billings and payments and all of that. I mean, it used to take us 28 days to get an invoice out the door. It now takes us 4 days to get an invoice out the door. You know, we did our payment run for May. It used to take us 16, 17 days to, you know, calculate everything off of spreadsheets and whatnot. It took us 30 minutes to do it this month. So it means our collections are so much quicker, which is why our cash position is so good. Again, I saw stuff written out there was utterly incorrect. I can't call it a lie. I'll just call it ignorant. That was saying that we weren't paying podcasters, and that's why our cash position was so good. We're just paying people more quickly because we're getting our money in more quickly, and that's what's changed our cash position. But that back office system is superb, and that combined with the other things that we're doing in the company just means we're absolutely rock solid at this point.
Marvellous stuff. And how have you done that? With the software or what? With new software or something?
Yeah, so it was so basically it's our own custom build of kind of application. So you could call it an application layer that's been put straight on top of Salesforce, and then using that as, if you like, the back end architecture that allows us to feed in all of our ad information and all of our inventory information, and we can put in the revenue splits in there as well, and it calculates what was served against what was available and what the price was, and then that backs into Xero, so we know exactly what all of our partners are due to be paid, and we can get that payment out the door ASAP. So, you know, we've reduced our debtor days down from 132 to just around 90. We've done that over the last 4 months, and we're going to be trying to drive that down even further as we move forward. So, you know, It's just a tight back office operation now.
Yeah, that was just a sort of personal anoraki software question from me. So anyway, yeah. So Rob, finally, as always, if someone's listening, likes the sound of the progress you're making, but are not following the story as yet, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button and add Audioboom to their watch list, please.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a great watcher of the overall AIM market, but Audioboom trading through this year, we're going to be up nearly 100% in revenue year on year on year for the last 3 years. 100% in revenues. I don't know if the top of your head you can name another AIM company that's done that recently. Don't know.
Not many, no.
So, yeah, so even within that context, awesome. Obviously, we're controlling costs. And our EBITDA is getting better all the time. We put a lot of hard yards in, and fair dues, a lot of our investors have walked those hard yards with us. We're now reaping the benefit of that. Because of those back office systems, again, you know, this will be a turn up on the AIM market. But overall, we are a major player in the podcast space globally. 85% of our revenue comes from the biggest market in the world, in the US. We're a major player in that space. We're now making tons of our own compelling content at much higher margins. And we've got a brand new revenue stream that will impact our overall revenues this year, which is Sonic IM. We've done all of the foundational work and we've bought the hard yards. It's now time, and we are doing, flex that model to drive revenues and drive the EBITDA. So, you know, we're a tech company. We have in some ways been incubated on AIM as a tech startup, which also must be a first. But we're now a business with a model that turns in very, very standard-looking metrics and returns for any AIM company, you know, even the mining and the oil and the gas and all of those boys. So yeah, you can view us as being a boring company at this point, but we operate in the most exciting area of digital right now.
Marvellous stuff. Rob, good to chat to you, and look forward to catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Well, as soon as we get those H1s out, mate, I'll be on.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Richard Holohan, CEO of Polarion. That's P-O-L-X ticker. Richard, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Justin. Appreciate being on.
Yeah, well, listen, you're new to the podcast. I've had someone on before talk about you, Vadim from SP Angel, giving you good coverage. But we've never had the CEO. And so, and I do this with all companies, Richard, when they first come on the podcast, even when they've been on lots of times, because we can never assume people listening know all about the company. So first and foremost, before you get into any news, any detail of what you're doing at the moment and your progress you're making, could you give us a brief summary as to what Polarion's all about, please?
Yes, absolutely. Happy to do that. So we are a drug device combination company. That's a regulatory designation that refers to the fact that we have a system which polarizes the inert noble gas xenon, which patients inhale, and make it a contrast agent for use in magnetic resonance imaging. So we visualize lungs and lung function for physicians, which is something that's never been done before.
Wow. So you're saying this has never been done before? So explain that again. So you use the neon gas, and patients inhale this. So take this through again, and how does this work?
Well, it's actually a great story and part of the history of medical imaging, which the UK figures prominently in because CT and MR were invented there. Mm-hmm. But after those technologies were rolled out to medicine globally and physicians and radiologists figured out how to use them, there were row-column intersections in the table of all possible clinical applications that were left behind. And lungs and pulmonary function turn out to be one of them for both of those technologies. So we've come along with our technology, which fills in the gap there. And essentially, we take the inert noble gas, xenon 129, mm-hmm. we put it in our polarizer, we excite it with a laser beam, and then the patient inhales it, and in an 8-second breath hold MR scan, we visualize the entire lung system and all of pulmonary function for physicians, and that's simply not possible any other way. And of course, the pulmonary docs have been kind of left with the oldest technology in medicine, which is just spirometry. Everybody's breathed into the plastic tube in one of those offices or hospitals. It's not very precise. It's not very reproducible. And it doesn't even give the docs information about left lung versus right lung. It's a horrible fact of medicine, but we're here to change that.
Yeah, and I assume this is quite a big market, isn't it?
Well, just to scale it, if you look at Vadim's, for example, you mentioned Vadim, our analyst. Mm-hmm. If you look at his research note, you would see that the burden to the U.S. healthcare delivery system of trying to take care of the sum of all patients with pulmonary dysfunction in the U.S. without our technology so far is some $150 billion annually. So there is just a huge opportunity to help medicine do a better job of taking care of these patients.
Yeah, so like you said, no one's ever done this before, so it's quite cutting edge. And where are you with this? I mean, I see you just you're conducting phase 3 clinical trials at the moment. Is that right?
We are. So the FDA considers us a drug device. Mm-hmm. So we are in our phase 3 trial right now in the U.S., which is a head-to-head non-inferiority trial versus an older technology. And so we are 80% complete in that trial. It has two pathways that we're trialing, and we should be done with enrollment of the trial in the third quarter of this year.
Yeah, so I assume that's the next big sort of milestone. Is it coming up?
Yeah, well, so end of enrollment, always a milestone in a small company kind of assessment. The next big milestone will be submission of our new drug application, our NDA, to the FDA. Mm-hmm. And then the next milestone after that, of course, is getting approval.
And once you get approval, I mean, how fast can this become commercial?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we are allowed under the regulations to provide these systems to researchers for use in research. And so we already have 24 systems out there operating at some of the best and brightest of medical imaging research and pulmonary research out there. We actually have systems in the UK as well. One of our best researchers is Dr. Fergus Gleason out at Oxford there. So we're leveraging those folks, they're actually assembled in a consortium for clinical trials. So we have all of those guys out there doing all of the clinical applications that everyone in someone's extended family knows about: asthma, COPD, emphysema, importantly for kids, cystic fibrosis. And so we'll be advancing all of those applications as we go and getting this to market as quickly as possible. We expect it will loosely follow the introduction of CT and MR. So same thing, you roll it out to the high end of medical teaching institutions and hospitals, and it goes down and out from there into smaller hospitals. Potentially, any hospital with an MR machine is a candidate for this technology.
Yeah, wow. Okay, and last week you conducted sort of an investor symposium, and you put this up online, is that right?
We did. So this is our second annual investor symposium. We had twice as many people this year as last year, and we took the advice of our attendees last year and kind of tilted the agenda away from the science and technology of this, which people are giving us as granted, given our IP portfolio in the space. Mm-hmm. And have moved most kind of directly into hearing stories from doctors and patients. So you'll see if you go to the video on our website, so that's under the investor tab on our website, and then under the audio and video selection on that tab, you'll see the entire symposium. And in it, you will see our CTO, Dr. Bastian Driehaus, presenting an overview of all of the applications, and then two very detailed drill downs into pulmonary arterial hypertension, which there is no other way to investigate non-invasively, and cystic fibrosis with kids. The first one's by Dr. Sudarshan Rajagopal at Duke University, and the second one by Dr. Jason Woods from the University of Cincinnati, Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, one of their leading places on the planet for research in cystic fibrosis.
Yeah, and by the way, if people want to see that video, you did release it as an RNSR, so if you go to Vox there and just look at the last bit of news is a link there to that video, so where you can see that. So, and is there any way of knowing? I mean, clinical, you know, phase three trials. Is there any way of knowing what the chances of success are?
Well, that's a great question, and particularly given the market's kind of recent experiences with people that that did not succeed in their phase three trials. In contrast to those which were pure drug trials that you never know the answer to and, until you're done, our trial is a head-to-head trial in a non-inferiority trial versus an imaging technology. We know instantly whether we won or lost. And we've already run a pilot study. I think you would have seen this in some of the research notes as well. Before we ever began the trial, we ran a mini trial ourselves using exactly the same technique and protocol. We did that handily. That gave us the confidence to launch the trial. The total scope of our trial is only 80 patients. So we're actually, we like our position here, and we're expecting to have no difficulty completing the trial successfully.
Marvelous stuff. Okay, Richard, that's very interesting. And like I said, this is quite a big year for you, isn't it, I suppose, coming up?
This is it, all right? We've spent the run-up from our IPO to here getting ready for these moments. You would see on the RNS pipeline, we have done our best to make a habit out of doing what we said we would do. When we said we would do it. So we are clicking off the milestone boxes as we go. We'll complete the enrollment here third quarter, complete our submission shortly thereafter, and expect to be in market late next year. So very excited about that.
Marvelous stuff. Okay, well, in summary, Richard, if someone likes the sound of this and not yet following the story, could you give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please?
Yes, absolutely. So I think several things. If you just took a quick scan of our RNSs and the research, you would see a well-equipped startup with a complete intellectual property portfolio, rapidly clicking development milestones on its way to commercialization. The entire model and valuation to date rests solely on the U.S. market. So we have significant upside in other geographics, other geographic markets, and it also rests at the moment only on pulmonary medicine, and we are already experimenting in cardiology, so upside there as well. And we're now entering a time period in our kind of development where we're beginning to have conversations and discussions with some very large strategically interested companies. You could probably guess who they might be, but drug companies for sure, and companies interested in assisting us with developing alternative geographic markets.
Marvelous stuff. Richard, it's good to chat to you. And like I say, a big year for you, so hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
We'll keep in touch. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Jonathan Tobin, Investment Director at Arix Bioscience. Ticker there is A-R-I-X. Jonathan, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, I've spoken to the CEO there before, Joe, and it's nice to get a different perspective. Like I say, you are investment director. But before we go into your background, where you've come from and the portfolio, can you give us a brief summary for people listening now, Jonathan, who are not familiar with Arix Bioscience, brief summary of what the company's all about, please?
Yes, Arix is a biotech venture capital firm, which means that our job is to find the most exciting small companies developing the next generation of medicines. We invest in the companies and we help them grow to reach valuable propositions. We're transatlantic, based in London, New York, and Munich. And we've been going about 3 years and built a portfolio so far of 16 companies, which is growing.
Marvelous stuff. Okay, and like you are investment director, so you are one of the most important guys there, I assume. So take us through your background, Jonathan, and where you came from to be here, and also maybe highlight a few other members of the team if you could.
So I started off as a scientist. I did my undergraduate at Oxford in biology. And from there, I went on to do a PhD in human genetics, focusing on some very rare diseases that cause blindness and obesity, which I did at Great Ormond Street Hospital in London. After that, I continued my scientific career as a scientist at Cancer Research UK, working on mechanisms of breast cancer formation. And then I moved into the biotech sector, first of all, working for a small company in a business development capacity. I then went to business school at Imperial College and got an MBA, focusing on investment. And at that point, I joined what was called Imperial Innovations, which was at the time a spin out of Imperial College and was a UK focused biotech VC firm. I stayed there for 5 years, concentrating almost entirely on creating new biotech companies, largely out of universities like Imperial, Cambridge, and UCL, and really learnt how to identify and build new companies. I then got a call in early 2016 with an opportunity to join this new company, Arix, which started about January or February in 16. And the opportunity there was very attractive because the mandate was a lot broader geographically to invest all over the world. There are great opportunities in the US, in other parts of Europe, in Australia. The great science exists everywhere, and biotech is really a global industry. After all, we're creating IP, which is very transportable. And since then, I've been helping to grow our portfolio, helping to build the team, and really helping to shape Arix into what is becoming a very, very exciting growth stage company itself.
Wow. Well, do you know what, Jonathan, listening to your CV there, I can say, in my humble opinion, you are suitably sort of experienced. That's quite impressive. Marvelous stuff. And just take us through the investment process then for Arix. What do you look for? What's your filters there?
Sure. So one thing that we've really worked hard at as a new firm is to build up our deal flow, which are the company's opportunities, ideas that we see. And that really is the lifeblood of a venture capital firm. And I think we're quite proud of the way that from a standing start, we've built up a funnel, which is seeing, you know, close to 1,000 new opportunities per year. And having that wide funnel is extremely important because we want to make sure we're seeing as many, if not all, of the good new ideas from across the world as a small team possibly can. And our ability to create that deal flow, I think, has been validated by four of our shareholders who are large pharmaceutical companies: Takeda, UCB, Ipsen, and Fosun, which span Europe, the US, and Asia, Japan and China. And those firms have invested in us largely to take advantage of some of the breadth of deal flow that we see. I think the second part of what we do is that we need to know what good looks like. And that applies both for the people that are managing the companies that we potentially invest in, and the scientists and the entrepreneurs, and also the science itself, both from a technical perspective and a market perspective. And I think the team that we have is pretty experienced. We've got a mix of people with an investment background, such as our CEO, Joe Anderson, my colleague, Mark Chin in New York, me. And then we have colleagues with a operational background, my colleague, Christian Schetter, who's based in Munich, who's run three biotech companies over the last 25 years. All of which have been successfully sold for profitable exits. And so we combine that experience of the team who've all seen both successes and failures. So I think we've got a pretty good benchmark for the kind of quality that we're looking for. And the last thing is that we are extremely choosy about what we invest in. So we end up closing deals on approximately 1% of the opportunities that we see. And so ultimately, we end up saying no to about 99% of things that come across the transom. But biotech is very, very difficult industry. It's very high risk. It's fraught with failures and ups and downs, roller coaster ride. And so we need to, you know, the skill of us as investors is being able to identify what we think has the highest chance of success. And from the portfolio that we've put together so far, I think it's looking pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in fact, take us through some, you know, bits of the portfolio, if you could. I mean, obviously not all 16 investments you have, is that right?
Yeah, we do. So they span everything from very, very early stage science projects, which we keep in what we call our discovery portfolio. And so some of those projects will produce very exciting results, which we can then scale up into more substantial companies. And then the bulk of our portfolio is what we call the core portfolio, which comprises 10 companies. About eight of those are in clinical testing. Two of them are actually in phase three testing, and we're expecting data this year from those trials, which, if positive, could lead to approved drugs for some pretty serious infectious diseases. And then we have companies that are in phase one and phase two, testing the safety and early efficacy of their products. But just to give you a flavor of the kinds of things that we do, one of the companies that I've been involved with from the beginning is a company called Artios, which is a spin out of Cancer Research UK, the big charity that funds a lot of the cancer science in the UK. And this is based on the idea of synthetic lethality, which takes advantage of genetic weaknesses or liabilities in particular tumors, which don't exist in normal cells. And the team that were behind Artios were the inventors of a drug called Lynparza, which is set to be a blockbuster drug, the first drug approved with this synthetic lethal mechanism by AstraZeneca. And so we backed that team really to develop the next generation of drugs in this area, which is set to become, it is becoming a very hot area in oncology. We got involved at the beginning with a part of a £25 million investment. And then last year, the company attracted a lot of interest, including from big pharma companies like Pfizer and Novartis, who've co-invested with us into this company. And it's now raised a total of £90 million. And we're expecting to take the drug into human testing next year. So to go from an idea to dosing patients within 3 to 4 years is pretty rapid progress. And it's been possible because we have a real expert team and a very highly qualified group of investors who have funded the company appropriately. And we're very excited about that one. Just at the other end of the spectrum of development, another company that I'm involved in called Atox Bio, which is a company based split between North Carolina in the States and Israel. And they have a product which is in phase three testing, close to the end actually, reads out the data pretty soon, for a devastating disease called necrotizing soft tissue infection, or gangrene. And the standard of care for those patients is amputation. So not many options for people that get that disease. This is the first drug that will have been tested in those patients. And so, and it's a novel mechanism, but if it works, and we'll know pretty soon, it could be transformational. So I think that the theme amongst all 16 of our companies is that they're doing first-in-class products, novel science. They all have highly experienced and entrepreneurial management that have done and been successful in drug development before. And all of our deals are syndicated with specialist biotech investors that have many, many years of experience of building new biotech companies and either floating them or selling them to big pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, listen, Jonathan, everyone who comes on the podcast, I ask the same question of, and every day on the podcast, I highlight the top five most followed companies on Vox Market. So to get on that list, give us three reasons, if someone's listening right now, why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add Arix Biosciences to their watch list, please.
Okay, well, the first one is that biotech is one of the highest growth areas in the economy at the moment. It's an extremely dynamic and exciting area. It's reaching record levels of growth and investment. And Arix, as a listed company on the main market, is really set up to give generalist investors who don't have the expertise in that sector access to some of the most cutting-edge innovation from across the world, and that includes the US and Europe, which are the two hotbeds of activity. I think the other thing that's important is that Arix itself is at the early stages of growth, and so as a young company, we've demonstrated the ability to raise capital, bring in high-quality investors, and cultivate an extremely rich pipeline of ideas and execute on 16 of those deals. We're now getting, I think, into our flow where last year we saw four IPOs and some of our companies are about to read out clinical data, which will lead to value inflections if positive. And this year we're expecting 19 such readouts. And so the next 12 to 18 months is a hugely exciting and could be transformational time for our business as the seeds that we've sown over the last 2.5 years are starting to bear fruit.
Yeah, absolutely. Sounds very interesting. Jonathan, thanks very much for coming on. And like you say, there's lots of news ahead of you. So hopefully we'll be catching up in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, SolGold, S-O-L-G, of course, up 22.38%. In fact, if anything touches gold at the moment, it's doing well because it's breaking out, of course, gold over $1,400 per ounce. Hasn't been there for 6 years. At four, Big Dish, D-I-S-H, big fall the last 2 days. At three, Venn Life Sciences, V-E-N-N. On the podcast yesterday, I highly recommend you listen to that if you haven't already. Cathill is the guy, CEO, his turnaround story, reversing takeover of Open Orphan. From the podcast yesterday. Very interesting, excellent track record. And he's raised money, twice the value of the market cap of the company. All right, so he raised twice as much, 4.5 million conditionally on the general meeting announcement next week, on passive resolutions next week, but at twice the price. So twice the price, it was, the share price was 2.6 pence. He raised money at 5.6, 4.5 million, and the market cap was like 2.6 million. And it's conditional for next week, but very interesting strategy going on there. Check it out, V-E-N-N. At two, Lecol. I've seen it mentioned a couple of times on Twitter. Don't know why, I don't know what the story is really. L-E-K is ticker there. And most followed company is Nanoco. It's fallen 73%. There's certain people, all they do is catch falling knives. And I don't understand the investment. This is not a sustainable rise. A dead cat bounce, you're in for what, a trade of 10, 15, 20% maybe, and out. I just prefer to invest in businesses that have, you know, a sustainable future. Nano is ticker there. Okay, top five most liked RNSs, or most read. At five, Westminster Group, new joint venture, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. At four, Bluebird Merchant, directed dealing. At three, Kefi, update on exploration at Hawaya Prospect. At two, Bushveld Minerals, Brits Vanadium, maiden mineral resource. And number one, most liked RNS, came from Big Dish, operational update, D-I-S-H, ticker there. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening.
Muchos apreciado.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.